First Amendment freedoms, and government transparency. This is the foundation to a healthy democracy. Welcome to the NEFAC Report, where we discuss your rights to free speech, freedom of the press, and an open, accountable government. I'm Alexandra Tavallone, production manager for the NEFAC Report and part of a student team at Roger Williams University working with the New England First Amendment Coalition. Thanks for joining us. In this episode, we'll hear from NEFAC's Jonathan Albano about a little-known controversy in the high-profile Karen Reed murder trial. John, a media attorney at Morgan Lewis in Boston, explains what reporter confidentiality protections exist in Massachusetts and discusses a brief that he wrote on behalf of NEFAC and other press groups. Later in the show, we'll hear from former NEFAC legal fellow Lindsay Vickers about Connecticut's Freedom of Information Act and her experience trying to obtain public records under the law. And let's just say it was an adventure. But first, here's NEFAC Executive Director Justin Silverman with attorney Jonathan Albano.
Thanks for joining us, John. Let's get right to it. We have this interesting part of the high-profile Karen Reed case that isn't getting as much publicity as other aspects of this trial are, and involves shield laws or the lack thereof in Massachusetts. So I'm going to have you describe a little bit about that trial, the memorandum that you wrote on behalf of a number of organizations, including NEFAC. But first, I need you to provide some context for those that aren't familiar with shield laws.
So a shield law, we should think of as similar to if you go to a clergy person and go to confession or something akin to that, there is a statute that says that's inadmissible in many, if not most, states. And interestingly, the government has the right to have confidential informants whose identities the government doesn't have to reveal, except under certain limited circumstances. Shield laws for reporters are designed to give them that kind of protection. And it all centers around one, I think, generally accepted principle that if you want to encourage people to speak, they need to have confidence that the communication is confidential.
So how do we square up the idea of a shield law with the Supreme Court case, Brandsburg v. Hayes? Because in that case, the Supreme Court seemed to be pretty clear that reporters themselves don't have any additional rights that other members of the public have.
Yeah, so Brandsburg is not really as bad, I would say, as it's often spoken about. What happened in Brandsburg was there were reporters who were witnesses to crimes. The Supreme Court said there was no absolute protection for reporters' confidential sources. But it's also true that in many of the critical separate opinion, the court did acknowledge that newspersons do have the right to seek relief from courts if confidential communications are being needlessly sought from a reporter, and expressly said that reporters would have access to the courts for a protective order to protect those confidential sources. Bottom line is, if you're a reporter who's a witness to a crime, then it's very tough to say, well, yeah, but they were all confidential sources and I saw the crime. That's tough. But if there are other circumstances where you can really question whether the law enforcement or the civil litigant needs the identity of the source to pursue its case, Brandsburg certainly left healthy and alive the notion that reporters could seek help from the court in those situations.
So bring us to the idea of a shield law then. If Brandsburg did in fact say that, why have some states since then enacted shield laws? And do they all look the same and provide the same kind of protections? And how common are these laws?
They're very common. Now we're talking about state court cases, okay? The federal system does not have a shield law. We rely on the federal courts to protect reporters there. But states have the right to do this. And several state legislatures have made the decision that either you just cannot get confidential source information because protecting those communications is so important to getting information out to the public, or at least you can only get them if a really serious demonstration of need for the source's identity is made, and if the government or the civil litigant couldn't just go somewhere else first and get the identity of the source from someone, from some alternative source. That's generally the scope of the state shield laws.
So now let's return to Massachusetts, where I think at this point, everyone in the country knows about the Karen retrial, the circus that's become. Smaller aspect of this trial involves a reporter from Boston Magazine, who was, before there was a mistrial and the second trial began, this particular reporter was ordered to provide her notes from an interview she had with Karen Reed, to prosecutors. Tell us a little bit more about that and procedurally how that went down.
Sure. So the defendant agreed to a series of news interviews. The prosecutors, not surprisingly, said, good God, the defendant's making a lot of statements about what happened that night. We cannot make her get on the stand to cross-examine her. But if she has made public admissions about things that happened, then we could use those statements to show she's told an inconsistent story, or maybe she admitted something in those interviews that could help the prosecution. So they subpoena networks, Boston Magazine, and others. What happens with networks is the stuff they broadcast, there's really no protection for that, right? You put it out there in the world, and many news organizations will say, yeah, you want our interview? Pay us a normal fee we charge, and we'll send you a copy. Gets a little trickier if it's the so-called outtakes that they haven't published. Then there's more of a fight. With the Boston Magazine, the issue was one interview that the reporter did with the defendant, which was agreed to be confidential. Nothing would be disclosed from that interview, the deal was, without the permission of the source. And nothing from that interview was or has been disclosed to the public. The prosecutors wanted to get the reporter's notes of that confidential interview to see if the defendant said anything that would help the prosecution.
Did those notes have to be disclosed, or did certain First Amendment protections come into play? Because again, we don't have a shield law in Massachusetts. We have to rely on Brandsburg and other state constitutional protections. So given that, what was the order in the first trial?
So the first trial left the reporter's notes alone. I think the government did not push particularly hard for those notes in round one. The judge did order the disclosure of anything that had been broadcast or aired by not just Boston Magazine, but by other, certainly in round two, by other stations as well. When the retrial came, the prosecution pushed for what it had not received in round one, which included the notes of this confidential interview.
So you, on behalf of NEFAC, Massachusetts Newspaper Publishers Association, the Reporters Committee, as well as New England Newspaper Press Association, wrote legal memorandum explaining to the court what protections are in place in lieu of a state shield law that would prevent the court from ordering the disclosure of these reporters' notes. What are the arguments you made?
We filed an amicus brief on behalf of Boston Magazine. Boston Magazine's lawyer, of course, Rob Birchie, had already briefed the legal issues in the case on behalf of the reporter. So our job was to try and explain a little more globally, a little more maybe even philosophically, why this is an important issue, why the court shouldn't just say, as, you know, really, people who aren't involved in First Amendment issues might be sympathetic to, have blinders on and say, these are statements relevant to the prosecution of a serious crime. They should be potentially in evidence. And the way we tried to go about doing that was to kind of step back and say, why are these principles important? What in the Brandsburg case actually supported the position we are taking now. And don't we all understand that there are things we just won't say, even to our friends, if we don't trust that our friend is going to keep it confidential? It's all the more so with people who have important information that is newsworthy, that the general public has an interest in learning about. And if people do not have protection, that they just won't communicate that information.
So ultimately, the arguments were made by Boston Magazine's attorney, Robert Birchie, who also happens to sit on our board. The memo was submitted by you on behalf of NEFAC and the other organizations. And the judge agreed in this case. This is a victory. This was a big win. So as we wrap up here, John, let me ask you, do you think that a shield law is needed in Massachusetts?
So the situation now is that in Massachusetts, judges will get mad at me for this, but it can really depend on the judge, right? There's no set standards. Our Supreme Judicial Court has said you should take into account the interests in protecting news gathering. You should make sure that there's a compelling interest in the need for the information. And if there's a readily alternative source, that should be considered too. But there's no hard and fast rule, as there are in other states, where you just know the confidential source is going to be protected. And that matters in many ways. First of all, you get the assurance that the source will be protected. Secondly, it stops a lot of unnecessary fighting and appearances in court and filings of briefs to try and convince a judge that this confidential source should be protected, because everybody knows from the outset they don't have the right to the confidential source.
Hey, this is Alexandra again. If you enjoyed the conversation between Justin and Jonathan, please check out our show notes. A link is provided wherever you're listening to this podcast. These notes include links to the brief that John wrote on behalf of NEFAC, an interview of Justin that recently aired on WCVB in Boston, and additional information about reporter shield laws. Also, please check out the many programs offered by NEFAC. With classes on open government and quick hit lessons on journalism and the First Amendment, NEFAC plays host every month to a growing audience of reporters, editors, and other curious community members. You can find a listing of all events, such as How to Start Your Own Podcast and Education Reporting 101 at NEFAC.org. Join us. Now, let's hear from former NEFAC legal fellow Lindsay Vickers about Connecticut public record laws.
Lindsay, thank you for joining. I want to have you speak about this project you worked on last summer as a NEFAC legal fellow. You spent a number of months making public requests of agencies in Connecticut. What agencies did you reach out to, and what records did you ask of them?
Yeah, so we decided to contact three different agencies. We selected them with journalists who kind of indicated that these agencies had given them trouble in the past. We wound up going with the Department of Public Safety, I believe, which is just where the state police are housed. And then we went with the Department of Corrections and the Department of Public Health. And for the Department of Police, the state police, we requested a few different arrest records for certain individuals who had been arrested within the state of Connecticut. We tailored each of the requests to the department for obvious reasons, especially because we wanted to make sure they were viable. But we chose specific individuals who had been arrested in the state within a relatively recent time frame and requested those arrest records. And then for the Department of Corrections, we picked a bunch of inmates at various facilities. I did research on which facilities had common solitary confinement kind of practices. And then I searched a bunch of common last names and just found random inmates from that facility with those common last names like Miller and Brown, and requested a whole slew of records from them. And then the last one that we did was the Department of Public Health.
So let's start off with the good news. Were there any agencies that got back to you with the information, the records that you requested in a reasonable period of time?
Yeah, I was actually really surprised. The Department of Corrections turned around pretty quick and uploaded all those documents. They also, for listeners who aren't aware, they didn't charge me. There's kind of a framework for people to be charged for public records because it is work that the government is doing, but you can request a waiver. And the Department of Corrections not only uploaded the records really quickly, but also didn't charge me for those. It was about a week after we submitted the request that we got all of the records back.
Those agencies that perhaps didn't respond as promptly as they should have under the law, which agencies, if any, were those?
The Department of Public Health has been an interesting challenge. They took a while to respond to my initial request. And in the course of responding, they were like, oh, actually, this is the responsibility of another agency. So then they booted me to that. Basically, we submitted the request in late July. And I got some batch of records a few days before I got married on December 17th. That one was pretty interesting and pretty slow.
So to be clear, pretty slow, meaning it took you 6 months to get any documents related to your request. Is that right?
Well, they actually sent me some earlier, but there was a batch that they couldn't send because they were regulated by the federal, I don't know, it was a federal disclosure law that came into play. So they had to send that request to a new organization for them to review them. So it was still months before I kind of heard back anything from them.
Did they provide all of the information that you initially requested, or were they still withholding certain documents that you had asked for to begin with?
You know, one of the problems with these sort of records requests is that you're kind of trusting the government. So as far as I know, I got the records that I needed, except for those federal agencies that maybe were withholding them for some other reason.
So you may have gotten all of the records that you requested. You may not have. It's hard to know whether or not an agency is providing all responsive records because you, Lindsay, are not the one searching for those records. You have to trust that government is responding accordingly under the law in good faith. And this is certainly an issue that others in different states are encountering as well. So you have one agency that responded pretty quickly in a reasonable manner. You have another agency that took several months to provide what we think could be all of the records, but we're not entirely sure. That leaves the state police under the Department of Public Safety. What was your experience requesting records from that agency?
The fastest response I got was the Department of State Police with a big asterisk. So the Department of State Police sent me one record really quickly. I think I requested two arrest records and they sent one really quickly. I had it on August 1st. They pulled the record and they said, we have the responsive documents, but you have to pay for them. So I paid the invoice a week later. And then I eventually got the records. What was more interesting with the state police department was there was one record that I requested and they were like, that doesn't exist for us. And I was like, okay, cool. What do you mean? They said, basically, that might be a city record, but we don't know that this person exists. So I was like, okay, I will call the local police department in that jurisdiction to see if they have the record for this person who was arrested. And then we did find out that they probably had the record for this person. So I actually wound up submitting another request to that individual agency, not the state police department.
For those that have never submitted a public records request, just very briefly explain to us what the process is.
Yeah, so it really depends on the agency. So all of the past organizations that I've talked about, the state police, the Department of Corrections and the Department of Public Health have online presences where you can submit the requests online, either via email or through a login to a portal that they take public records requests. And that's pretty typical for larger agencies, but it's not always the case and they're not required to do it. So it's just a nice to have when you do find it. But with smaller agencies like these local police departments, they have to give you records if you ask for them, but how they do it is kind of up to them. So with this department, I called them and I was like, hey, can I get these records? And they were like, sure, send us in the mail a document with this request.
All right. So you're now dealing with this police station, which is which town, by the way, Lindsay?
It was Hartford Police Department.
So you're dealing with Hartford PD. You're trying to make a public records request under law. Again, these are records that you're entitled to under the law, but Hartford PD is requiring you to submit your request through the mail, snail mail, hard copy.
Yes. So I called them and they were like, you need to send us a prepaid envelope and check. And I'm like, okay, that's great. I also don't have a checkbook. You cannot send a personal check, they clarified. You have to send a money order or cash. Like these are the two options we take.
You go through all of this, you send out the request with the proper amount of money included. What happens then?
The story continues because I had requested certified mail. And if you don't know about certified mail, basically the person who receives it has to sign for it because That's the whole certification thing, is to make sure it goes to the right person and doesn't get misdelivered, which in public records is super important, because how can you can't hold the government accountable for something if you don't know what's going on. So it's only fair that I get certified mail on the way back. But I left town in September for several weeks to go to overseas, to England and Italy. I was like, oh my God, like I can't sign the little slip to get them to release it into my mailbox. So when I got home about a week later, I would say after the first delivery attempt, I found the paper and it said, we will hold this record until this date. And it was 2 days after I got back. So I was like horrifically jet lagged the first night because we got back quite late. And the next day I was like, I'm going to USPS to get this records request because they're going to throw away my mail if I don't show up today. So I did get the records I'd requested in the end.
Quickly for us, Lindsay, put everything in perspective. You know, what did you learn here from this whole exercise when it comes to not just you as a journalist, but all members of the community, those that live in Connecticut and otherwise trying to get information from government and having, in some cases, to jump through all of these hoops just to get simple police documents?
At the end of the day, the people who answer the phone are often just people who they're not out to get you about your public records request. Like they want to get it out of their way too, because it's their job. So it was kind of nice to see that part of things, that in some ways the system functions. That said, I think that there's, you know, something to be said for maybe having standardization for allowing people to submit records requests online, for updating the law to give people a timeline to respond to and not just saying it has to be prompt. From the journalistic side, it's really hard to do your job when you're being blocked from getting records that are super relevant to public accountability and public knowledge. So the takeaways for me were good and bad. It was like, oh, I can see how this system works. And that makes me feel a little bit relieved about the state of democracy and government transparency. Like it is kicking in, it is working. Like the records are coming to me, even if sometimes it's slow, which I don't stand for, but even if it's slow, they're getting to me at the end of the day in a lot of cases. I do think the main thing is diligence. If you want the records, you're going to have to put in a lot of work. So just make sure that if you're, you know, the one requesting them, you're ready for a somewhat uphill battle, because it isn't just going to be handed over to you so easily in some cases.
Thanks again for listening to the NEFAC report. Join us next time when we speak with NEFAC President Gregory V. Sullivan about unconstitutional speech ordinances in New Hampshire. Here's a preview.
The Supreme Court of the United States said if there is a bedrock principle underlying the First Amendment, it's that the government may not shut us up just because society as a whole is offended. We have the right to be offensive.
We'll also hear from NEFAC's Harrison Stark about why it can be difficult, if not impossible, to get certain Vermont court records online.
Vermont, like many other states, has struggled at times to navigate the tension between transparency and privacy.
This program is produced by the New England First Amendment Coalition in partnership with Roger Williams University's Communities of Hope and under the guidance of Professor Bernardo Mata. I want to give a shout out to our student team, David Peters and Matthew Downey for the editing, Anna Pellegrini for the program logos, Will Feingold for music, Sarah Price for the show notes, Brianna Frisora for promotion, and Lex Benson Amaranti for production assistance. We'll see you next time.